It doesn't appear that there is much private sector attention being given to tuberculosis as a specific disease. There is a lot of private sector money going into AIDS. Now, that's not to say that it isn't needed. It's absolutely needed, but I think we need to put it in both areas.
In most developing countries, once a patient is resistant to the common anti-tuberculosis drugs, there are no other options.
Tuberculosis versus the world on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Many Americans think of tuberculosis as a disease of the past, like polio or smallpox. In fact, this destructive infectious disease was nearly wiped out in the Western world over the last few decades. But TB is back, and it's on the rise nearly everywhere. Here to talk with us about it are several experts from key organizations in the battle against tuberculosis. Frank Lestumbo is from the National Council for International Health. Dr. Zita Rosenberg is from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Gabriel Shmunez is from the Pan American Health Organization. Dr. Carl Western is from the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. First, we hear from Dr. Basil Veraldzis of the U.S. Agency for International Development.
The first thing that our listeners need to know, I think, is that tuberculosis never really went away in the developing world. In developed countries, we've been very fortunate in that we've had appropriate treatments and access to care, et cetera, so that people were able to get treated and we were able to get the disease under control. That was the case up until the mid-1980s. And then we started getting into issues of homelessness and drug use and a variety of other social problems that prevented people from getting the care they needed. So compliance with care became an issue in the United States, and we ended up developing a lot of people that were resistant to the treatments, primarily because they weren't able to take the full course of treatment because of poor adherence to therapy. You add the HIV epidemic to that, and you can see we have a big problem in the United States. In developing countries, the issues are somewhat different. We've got a huge HIV AIDS epidemic around the world, as we all know. And that is contributing to the rise of tuberculosis to some extent. But the larger factor there is that there simply is not access to care. In most developing countries, people with tuberculosis cannot get the proper treatment that they need and deserve. And so you have a continuation of the infectious cycle. People get TB, they cough, they're infectious to other people, they infect new people, and the cycle continues.
Zita Rosenberg, NIAID, NIH. I think Basil explained the domestic issue here. From about the 1950s to the mid-1980s, there was a constant 6-7% decrease per year in the number of TB cases, and that was because of a concentrated, focused TB control effort to rapidly identify and treat infectious tuberculosis cases, so that the quicker you can identify someone and put them on adequate therapy, the more rapidly they are not infectious. Usually within 2 weeks of appropriate treatment, an infectious case is rendered non-infectious. So you can see that rapid identification and treatment is essential. When you have the emergence of drug-resistant TB, the diagnostic tests and the drug-resistant tests to determine what drugs an organism will be sensitive or resistant to can sometimes take 6 weeks to several months. So that if you start an individual with drug-resistant TB on the standard course of chemotherapy, they will not become non-infectious, and you will not know what drugs they are actually sensitive to for several months, so that you have people who may be infectious for much longer periods of time. So the emergence of drug-resistant TB has also helped fuel the increase in number of cases because people are infectious longer.
All right. And Dr. Western?
I'm Carl Western. During my medical career, I've faced tuberculosis as a clinician, and I've been responsible for control programs here in the United States in Virginia in the 1970s. And about 15 years ago, I worked for the World Health Organization's Regional Office for the Americas in charge of oversight, not direct management, of the tuberculosis program in the Americas. And I would agree with the statement that on a global basis, tuberculosis never went away. But as Dr. Rosenberg mentioned, here in the USA, it was going away. And dramatic, sustained progress was being made until a few years ago. The problem in developing countries was that tuberculosis is an important problem, but it's one of a large number of important problems. And for the majority of poor countries, including most of the countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, there were so many other serious problems that frequently TB was not given the attention it deserved. Another feature of the problem in the tropics was that there was no magic bullet for tuberculosis. There is a vaccine, BCG vaccine, which, though there's some argument about the degree of its effectiveness, is not a perfect vaccine. Unlike many infectious diseases where you get two or three shots of penicillin and you should be cured, tuberculosis requires a daily drug administration once upon a time for 1 or 2 years. Now, fortunately, there are much shorter courses of chemotherapy, and those of us who've tried to remember to take a pill every day, let alone several pills, know how difficult that can be. So TB never went away in the world. It was going away in the USA, and for many of the reasons that Dr. Rosenberg mentioned, it's coming back.
I'm Frank Listumbo of the National Council for International Health. We're a membership organization, and we're quite pleased to participate in this panel because one of the major roles of our organization is to facilitate an informed analysis of what the latest issues are in the health arena. And clearly, tuberculosis is one of those problems that require both a balanced and informed analysis of what is happening as well as what should be done. I can recall when I was working in the disease back in 1957 and 58, and as Basil said earlier, the disease has been around a long time, so it's not something new. However, what is new is the globe is getting smaller. Populations are moving, people are moving, they're traveling, whether it be for pleasure or for business or for whatever purposes. And because of that, when you have a neighboring country which has 300 or 400 cases per 100,000 versus a nearby country which only has half that number, you can see very readily, because of the contagious nature of the disease, that these moving populations are spreading the disease. And I want to make it clear that it's because of this large number of movement of people all over the world that we now have to deal with a problem that should have been and could have been prevented much earlier had we been prepared for it in terms of focusing our global attention to it. It's clearly local problems, but it has to be treated in a global manner. So I think these are the kinds of things we need to be giving attention to. Another interesting insight here is when we polled our members, and NCIH has well over 100 private voluntary organizations or non-governmental organizations, as the term used these days, and in polling them, many of them got back and said, "Frank, we don't have someone who's really working in tuberculosis." And I said, "Why not?" They said, "Well, you know, we're not getting private sector funding for specific tuberculosis activities." So I think one of the things here is that while in other areas such as AIDS and diarrhea and other maternal and child health, you have both a private sector and a public sector response occurring out there at country level, that balance is not present with tuberculosis. And I think because of that, I think we need to speak out and say we need a private sector response to balance what funds and resources governments are able to put into this problem.
I am Gabriel Shmunis from the Pan American Health Organization, which is the regional office of the World Health Organization. I agree what Dr. Varelsis and Western have said. in Latin America and most of the developing countries, TB has been and it is an important health problem. Actual estimates indicate that in the region of the Americas, mainly Latin America and the Caribbean, there are about 230,000 cases reported per year, but the real incidence is probably double than that. In addition, there are a significant number of chronic cases of lung tuberculosis. At least half of the real incidence and all of the prevalence of chronic cases is lung tuberculosis patients with positive Mycobacterium in sputum, highly contagious and responsible for the spread of the disease. For almost 80% of the population of Latin American and Latin American and in the Caribbean, tuberculosis is a great public health problem. They are exposed to the germ either because of the number of individuals infected or sick, or the impossibilities of the countries to implement an effective prevention and control program.
I want to ask, first of all, Dr. Rosenberg, you talked a little bit about the infectious nature of this disease. Tell us, you know, for our listeners, how they contract TB and what precautions they can take.
Tuberculosis, the organism that causes tuberculosis, is spread through the air from an infectious individual to a non-infected individual. And it is spread usually through the infected individual coughing or sneezing or singing, somehow expelling air. And it is spread in little micro droplets in the air. And it is not very infectious as you compare it to measles or other infectious diseases like chickenpox. It is not something where if you're with a person in a room for 15 minutes, like influenza, you can get infected. Luckily, it is very difficult to contract. And there is a saying or a suggestion that for a healthcare worker, that their chances of becoming infected with tuberculosis are high if they work with a patient 8 hours a day for 6 months. So you see that it really does take prolonged contact with an infectious case in order to develop, in order to become infected yourself. And that is presumably because an immunocompetent individual, someone with a very competent immune system, can handle a certain level of organisms effectively and actually eliminate them from the body.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with a number of experts about the global fight against tuberculosis. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Tuberculosis alone poses a global healthcare crisis. But when TB is crossed with the AIDS epidemic, the results are catastrophic, not only for individual victims, but for the total healthcare infrastructure. Dr. Carl Western describes the deadly link between AIDS and tuberculosis.
A person who is infected with the AIDS virus, HIV, has a depression in their immune system and is increasingly unable to mount an effective immune response. If that person, let's say they're living in the tropics, has been infected early in life with the tuberculosis agent and it's sleeping there, so to speak, the decreased immune capacity will permit the organism, which had been dormant, to reactivate and produce increasingly serious disease. If there is an HIV-infected person who's living, let's say, here in Washington, D.C., and the majority of U.S. citizens do not test positive by skin test for tuberculosis, if that U.S. citizen becomes HIV-infected, has a decrease in their immune system and then is exposed to tuberculosis, whether at work, in their family, in their close associates, they are more susceptible to getting infected, and because they're already immunosuppressed, may develop rapidly advancing diseases, often with very little early symptoms, such as conversion of their skin test or clinical symptoms as well.
All right. Dr. Rosenberg?
Right. There needs to be a distinction made between TB infection and TB disease. When an individual gets infected with the microorganism, they have about a 5% chance over the next 2 years of developing active tuberculosis. Then, if they do not develop active TB, usually within 2 years, the organism can remain dormant for the rest of the individual's life. Oftentimes, as there's another 5% chance of developing active TB later on in life, as normal aging occurs and the immune system gets depressed in normal aging. So basically, it's a 10% lifetime risk of developing active tuberculosis once you're infected with TB. Now, if you are HIV infected and your immune system is depressed, your risk becomes about 10% per year of developing active TB. There actually, to my knowledge, is not any data to suggest that an HIV-infected individual is infected more easily with tuberculosis. It's just that once they are infected, their chances of developing active disease are much higher right away. It actually becomes an acute infection rather than a chronic infection.
All right, Dr. Rosenberg, I'm glad you made the distinction. Perhaps some of our listeners have had the TB test, where I think usually it's done on the arm and it's a circular thing, and if it, I'm not sure exactly how that works, but what are they testing for? Are they testing for the infection or for active TB?
What they're testing for is an immune response, a delayed type hypersensitivity, or an immune response to the organism, which means that you have been infected, you have been exposed to the organism. That does not necessarily mean that you have active disease. The only way to determine active disease is now to look for a chest x-ray, to look for evidence of tuberculosis in the lungs, if you have symptoms, a cough, a fever. But the majority of individuals, 90%, 95% of those with a positive skin test will not have active tuberculosis and may never, ever develop active tuberculosis.
All right. Mr. Listumbo, we talked a little bit about this connection between AIDS and TB. And if that's the case, why aren't we getting more international help, more money in this fight against the TB epidemic?
I think one of the most important things to consider in that is the health sector is perhaps the least funded sector. And since you're depending on the public area now to provide funds, like, for example, USAID provides tremendous amounts of funds for international work, and that's what many of our member organizations depend on. I think it's very easy to see where funds are shifted to those activities which seem to be the highest priorities. AIDS is a tremendous problem, and so we've had to put tremendous effort behind AIDS. I think diarrhea and diarrheal diseases, immunization, all of these other areas are important and need attention. I think tuberculosis was one of those things that just was kind of ignored, felt it was under control. And I think now, as I mentioned earlier, this great movement of people all over the globe has perhaps accentuated and exacerbated the problem, which without that may have stayed in its sort of a dormant state. So I think funding means really reallocating our resources a little differently, and funding also means giving health an important role when we talk about economic development and democratization and social development. Health or development of the human capability is a key ingredient in that process. If we haven't got healthy people, we're not going to have good economic and social development. So I think it's a matter of reorienting the resources we have and perhaps marshaling the private sector to put some resources. As I mentioned earlier, it doesn't appear that there is much private sector attention being given to tuberculosis as a specific disease. There is a lot of private sector money going into AIDS. Now, that's not to say that it isn't needed. It's absolutely needed, but I think we need to put it in both areas.
All right. Dr. Rosenberg?
again, a distinction to be made about international versus domestic. It is true that over the last several decades, domestically as well, there was a general gradual diminution of funds for TB control because the problem was going away almost by itself, which we now know is not true, but it seemed to be that way. In the last several years, both the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institutes of Health have increased their budgets for tuberculosis. For NIH, which I can speak for, we've more than increased it by tenfold since 1992, and a lot of effort is going into the research part now.
Mr. Lestumbo,
I was going to say that's an important point because, as you know, in the United States where we've talked about health reform, access is an important component. And there are still a large number of Americans who do not have access to services. And it's because the health systems, their capacity has been strained because even with the resources they have, they're not able to reach out to many of these individuals and target populations, with particularly within urban areas, that are not able to be reached. So that's an important area where that also needs to be strengthened.
All right. I want to bring in Dr. Raoulzis to talk a little bit about treatment. Is the treatment per individual something that is cost prohibitive, or would you call it a rather inexpensive treatment? And then how does the cost change when you start finding more drug-resistant strains?
Okay, let me focus on international issues here. Treatment for tuberculosis, according to a recent report that came out by the World Bank called the World Development Report, is actually the most cost-effective health intervention for adults that's available in developing countries. For individual patients, the average cost of treatment in developing countries for tuberculosis is between $13 and $45. That's for the cost of drugs, which is the primary cost. Once you develop resistance, the issue changes from cost to availability of treatment. In most developing countries, once a patient is resistant to the common anti-tuberculosis drugs, there are no other options. So, you know, once you've used that $45 or $50 regimen, there is no other option. In the U.S., we do have options, and Dr. Rosenberg could go into that in more detail, perhaps. But in developing countries, we don't.
The last big section I wanted to talk about was the scope of the global fight. Maybe we should just go around again, and we'll start with our USAID representative, Dr. Veraldis, to talk about the global scope of the fight against this epidemic.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is primarily a development agency, and it provides all the foreign assistance for development of the U.S. government. Now, as such, health is a fairly small part of our overall budget and our overall scope of activities. Within health, our primary priorities at this point have been child survival and AIDS. And what we're doing at this point is we are in the process of reorganizing the agency, and we're re-looking at our priorities. And one of the things that is becoming very apparent is that tuberculosis is an issue that needs to be addressed. We're looking at that within the scope of AIDS, given the connection between HIV and tuberculosis. As you may know, in some developing countries, between 60 and 80% of TB patients are also HIV infected. And likewise, TB is now the most common HIV-related condition in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. So we are in the process of studying various interventions that may be feasible.
And Dr. Schmitz?
We believe, as a regional office of the World Health Organization, that the fighting tuberculosis for most of the countries of the region, except of the two or three countries that are really as poor as those in the sub-Saharan countries, that is mainly fighting tuberculosis is a country responsibility. International aid must not replace the national effort, because international aid is not sustainable. Our function is to advocate the importance of tuberculosis among the governments and help the governments to help themselves. How? To implement effective prevention and control programs. This doesn't mean that the government doesn't need all the help they can get. The international community has an important role advocating. In addition, NGOs has also an important role, mainly providing drugs when it's needed.
Mr. Listumbo? You know, you've heard many of us say that tuberculosis has been around for a long time. And back when it was around, back in the old days, they say you literally had a who's who of artists and intellectuals and famous people who suffered or died from tuberculosis over the years. People such as Henry David Thoreau or Franz Kafka or Robert Louis Stevenson or D.H. Lawrence or Edgar Allan Poe. Now today, it's almost the opposite is true. It's one of the few major diseases that the general public does not identify with a contemporary celebrity. So while a third of the world's population may be infected with the TB germ, it still remains an invisible infector or visitor among the ranks of celebrities, which is so easy to cure. And now one of the problems, too, is that a recent public figure, Nelson Mandela, when he was in jail, we understand that he contacted tuberculosis while in prison. Another famous person is Val Kilmer, who plays the TB-ravaged Doc Holliday in the recently released movie Tombstone. Now, because the perception is not out there that this is really an important activity, then it tends to be one of the lower priorities when we're already faced with health priorities that are more beyond the resources we have available. And that's why, in fact, one of the things that USAID and the private sector is trying to do is reach a partnership whereby we can share strategies and coordinate activities at country level. Now, believe me, that's a difficult task. It is not easy. But Brian Atwood has started that task with the private sector community, and NCIH is one of the organizations that has been helping to push that partnership. So I think one of the things we have to do is change the perception of the public. For example, the public has perhaps a rather low perception of what's called foreign assistance. Foreign assistance for us really means providing health funds for developing countries. And in providing those funds, there are marvelous models and experiences and opportunities which are available for applying right here in the United States in our urban countries and in our rural areas, our urban cities, I'm sorry, where these can be applied and the lessons can be utilized in things like social marketing, better articulating the problems to the public. These are the kinds of things that we badly need to do here. And this is part of the very complex health reform that the president is trying to initiate. I think one of the important things we need to remember is in the international health community, we've learned a lot by pursuing primary health care. And in doing that, we have some marvelous lessons and you might say low-tech ideas that can be implemented here in the United States. And I think we need to pursue that, and I think we need to change the public's perception. And I think folks who are in public positions and decision-making positions need to understand that there is a wealth of information and material that we can share from other countries. And that's the only way, by redistributing our resources and coming together as partners, can we begin to make progress against things like tuberculosis.
That is Frank Listumbo from the National Council for International Health. Our other guests included Dr. Basil Veraldzis of the United States Agency for International Development, Dr. Carl Western of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, Dr. Gabriel Shmunez of the Pan-American Health Organization, and Dr. Zita Rosenberg of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. I'm Keith Porter. Printed transcripts of this program are available for $5. Audio cassettes are $11.70. Call toll-free 1-800-825-5746 and ask for program number 9411. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa. However, to order tapes or transcripts, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.